this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Y'allitics World Headquarters in downtown Dallas.
For what it's worth, this is it. We have we're doing things a tad bit different today because we have to, you know, well, some of us dressed up, dress up and like be a little more mature. We have a Pulitzer Prize winner with us today, which is a first for Y'allitics.
I should have worn a jacket. I'm the only one without a jacket on.
So we're not having any beer today. Thanks for preparing, Wheeler.
Yeah,
we want to get
shows.
Wanna,
I'm not worthy.
We want to get into the conversation here. Let's just since we're not having the beer, I'm dropping my stuff here. Let's just
that's karma. That's what that's called. Karma.
Yeah. Let's hop right into the conversation. We have with us one face that you'll likely recognize. He joins us a lot for the political take on what's happening. Bud Kennedy, columnist with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He's a regular on Inside Texas Politics with us every Sunday. He's on all of our election coverage as well.
And a friend of the podcast.
A long time. The friend of the podcast.
The friend.
I'm here for the beer.
He was here for the beer and we left it out.
Did they tell you we're having beer?
No, they didn't say no beer.
They didn't say no beer, right?
Join me in taking your jacket off in protest, Bud.
So, few people are as plugged in as Bud, in my opinion, politically in Texas politics. He also has a huge social media following as well. Do you want to take the honors for Mr. McKenzie?
I do. Even though I don't have a jacket on, I'm going to go ahead and say it. William McKenzie is the senior editorial advisor at the George W. Bush Institute. He's also an adjunct journalism lecturer at SMU who teaches a course on media and politics. And it just so happens that we are getting into both of those spheres today in our Venn diagram, meeting in the middle on that. He is a Fort Worth native, served 22 years as an editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. And gentlemen, you all go way back.
But whoa. You left the meat out here, bro.
You already said he won the pool.
Let's mention it again.
Yeah.
Don't just brush over that.
So yeah, don't just brush over it. And you won the Pulitzer Prize. Tell us what year and what that was for.
2010. Yeah. There are three of us that won it together for a project, editorial project the Morning News had. Looking at the gaps between the southern and northern halves of Dallas, and looking in terms of economics, cultural, education, healthcare, a number of other indices, looking at these different two sectors of Dallas and advocating for a number of solutions. This project ran, I want to say, 7 or 8 years, maybe longer. I left while it was still going in 2013 or 14, so it was still going at that time. So Sharon Grigsby, a columnist for the Morning News, was the lead of it, and Colleen McCain-Nelson, who's now editor of the Sacramento Bee, and Todd Robertson, who's now retired. The three of us won it together for our work on this project.
That's great. And for people who don't realize, that Interstate 30 essentially divides Dallas.
Right.
Socially, racially, right. Economically. And you guys really examined that in this in this project.
Right, right.
Terrific. And then Jason was saying, too, that before the camera started rolling, you guys were classmates. Seventh grade, Stripling Middle School. Is
this
that what it was, Bud?
Junior high. They were not called middle school.
Last century.
Last millennium.
That's all I'll say about how long ago it was. But you know, we started together in junior high in seventh grade. And it was a time of change in America. It was a time in the mid to late 60s, and we were in school. We also fell in alphabetical order sometimes, Kennedy and McKenzie, in classes. But Bill had gone to a different elementary school, but we met in junior high, and it was a time of desegregation. We've talked before about how the first desegregated schools in Fort Worth were that year. That was the year that students whose parents were at what was then Carswell Air Force Base, children of airmen, were allowed to come to school. We're desegregated Stripling Junior High.
So it was like the Wonder Years here. You guys lived the history.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you all spent every day with each other at lunch too, right?
Yeah. So we were
there was a special
in
lunch
Barbara
table.
Taylor's homeroom. How about that?
Well, I didn't remember that you were there. But Miss Taylor, the speech teacher.
Yep.
And you say that the lunch table was the safe table.
What does that mean, buddy? Because I missed that.
Do you remember middle school or junior high?
I do remember it. Yeah.
Well, just think about that. Okay. Yeah. Right, just a little.
We,
It can get dangerous.
No, it can get dangerous.
You had to either be at the safe table because you didn't want to get thrown into what was called the spit pit. And it was
spit
this
pit.
Horrible little gap between the playground and the building that everybody just spit down. And if so anytime anybody wanted to be roughed up in middle school, they'd throw you into the spit pit.
Wow, insult to injury.
That would be the rough part.
We were a mature bunch.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we have these two esteemed journalists in here because we're talking about the headlines that you might have seen.
Some of the headlines you didn't see.
Exactly. Specifically
on the editorial page.
The Washington Post and Los Angeles Times both, for the first time in a number of years, decided not to endorse in the presidential race. And that's what we're really digging into here in this episode.
Even though in this case, by all appearances, these were endorsements that had been prepared by the staff in favor of Vice President Kamala Harris for president in 2024, but both were struck down by the billionaire owners of the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post. A lot has been said about this on, of course, all parts of the political spectrum. At first blush, what is your read on this when you saw this coming down on these two papers that are watched by so many people in this country?
Oh, come on.
You get to go first, bud.
Well, I mean, I'm representing the cynical side here today. Newspapers have always reported to their oligarch owners. In the old days, for the whole 20th century, newspapers were the communications oligarchs. Those owners sometimes owned television stations, radio stations. Newspapers were all conservative Republican newspapers until 1992, with the exception of LBJ and 64, some papers broke. But 1992 was the first time newspapers started endorsing anyone Democratic at all. The Washington Post did not endorse a candidate in 1988. They wrote that Bush and Dukakis both were disgusting and they weren't endorsing either one of them. But the owners were always staunch conservative, and A.J. Liebling, the great press critic from The New Yorker, wrote, "Freedom of the press belongs to the man who owns one."
So this isn't unprecedented then for owners to meddle.
Well, I will say I was fortunate to have work for ownership local here in Dallas that didn't meddle, so that was good. And I will say that if you own the paper, you own the paper, and somebody eventually gets to call the shots. I think probably what is the issue or problem, whatever you want to call it, in both LA and Washington is they were down the pike, and they are ready to print these, evidently, just based on what I read.
Yeah. And then
they yanked it back. Is that the owner's prerogative? Yes, I mean, the person owns the paper, they can do that. Is that really the way to do it? I would argue not. I think I've gone around on this. I think it is perfectly fine for newspapers to not endorse at the presidential level, and I'll explain why in a second. But if they want to, I can see them doing it to express their principles. And the Morning News is not endorsing, it didn't in 20. And I understand that, because today, newspapers, regional newspapers, that is, don't really get to see the candidates. We were talking before the show started, Bill Clinton, Paul Tsongas, Jerry Brown debated in these very studios in Channel 8 in 1992. Each of those individuals came by across this alleyway here to interview with the Dallas Morning News, seeking their endorsements. That was common. That doesn't happen today. And so, you're making your assessment based on what you see on television or read about. You're not getting a one-on-one case. We knew George W. Bush well because he was governor and had run, and so you had a lot of exposure to him. So you get a sense of the person. They don't have a sense of the person. And so I can understand why you wouldn't endorse, the national papers, which I would put certainly the Post in, and I think the Times, LA Times too, but the Journal doesn't endorse, and so that the New York Times does. So there are a handful of national papers. I'm talking mostly about the regional papers. I understand why they wouldn't do it, and I don't think you're persuading, but I don't think you're really influencing the vote, because people are making up their minds anyway. I think where it makes a difference is at the state and local races, and it makes a big difference there in terms of just informing people.
to your point, though, about, you know, it looked like the train had left the station in both of these instances where these, you know, these endorsements were actually prepared and then struck down at the last minute. A lot of folks have come out and said that, you know, it would have been better if you wanted to have a policy like this, that you developed that policy a year ago, 2 years ago. We all knew that this was going to be the election year, 2024, that it might not have had so much blowback if that had been decided a year or two ago.
I think the way that this should have been handled, you may disagree, is that with every endorsement, it used to be emphasized that this is our endorsement, send us your endorsement. You know, people could write guest columns giving their endorsement. People were encouraged to write letters. We don't get nearly as many letters as we used to with endorsements. So the way this should have been handled, if the publisher or owner of the paper really felt like we just can't do this, then they explained that, but then what was written should have run as the opinion of the editorial board, as a signed column by the members of the editorial board. That still should have been published as a commentary. Other people should have been welcome to send their commentary and say, this is not an endorsement, this is an opinion of the members of the board. And the fact is, you have to have, we used to talk about the editorial page has to be the salad bowl of ideas, and you have to welcome all sides. I think the way this was handled by these owners who are not terribly familiar with journalism was not in the way that seemed the most open to other ideas.
Let me ask you about the circles, journalism circles, because this is becoming a huge deal. Columbia Journalism Review, one of the industry magazines, had a really interesting take on this. But the former Washington Post editor, Marty Baron, wrote on X the other day on Friday that his former employer was, quote, disturbing spinelessness at an institution famed for courage. Then across the pond, The Guardian says there's no way to see this decision other than as an appalling display of cowardice and a dereliction of their public duty. Goes on to say, these are the Brits talking about us here. It's a shameful smackdown of both papers' reporting and opinion writing staffs who have done important work exposing Trump's dangers for many years. At a bigger level, does this send a message, do you think, politically?
No.
Doesn't?
I don't. I think it matters to what matters to those newspapers, and if I were those newspapers, it would matter to me a lot. Particularly if I had written the editorial and put the effort into it. But I don't think really outside of journalism circles, I don't think the average person talks about this. And if I can go back to this idea, more than they pick up in this case, the Dallas Morning News or the Star-Telegram, and when they go vote, they want to see about your judicial candidates, you want to see about your state rep, you see your state Senate, you can see your member of Congress, you can see all these judges that we elect in Texas. Granted, it's less sexy, I get that. But that is where you have, I think, more influence as a newspaper. Influence in terms of informing people about here's who these candidates are. Most of us don't know who these are. And this is what we see. You go make up your own mind. This is who we see and recommend. See what you think.
Yeah, oftentimes those are good cheat sheets for a lot of people because those lower ballot candidates, you don't have as much background on them. You don't know the history as much. You do know the marquee races usually at the top.
Yeah, we're a primary information source on down ballot candidates. And those are some of our most read things we publish, editorial commentary. It's interesting there's a debate between newspaper companies now about editorials and opinion. Gannett, which owns the Austin paper and some others in Texas, has downplayed it. Our company, McClatchy, owns about 30 newspapers. Opinion is 20-30% of our page views sometimes. Our down ballot editorials have been tremendous in readership because there's no other place to find out about the place for city council seat or who the candidates are for school board than our editorial.
That's interesting that you say that. I saw something in Pointer and they were talking specifically about Gannett. And they said that Gannett found that through extensive studies that digital editorials in particular, when people are reading these on the website, were among their least read content. But that flies in the face of that, bud.
And McClatchy's had tremendous success, and I think it's because they have they've taught everybody, they have a formula that editorials need to be punchy, pointed, that they everything you need to bring people to the web, everything you need to get people to click that link on the phone and say, okay, this makes a point. This is something I want to read, raise curiosity, and just be, you know, bring something strong to say. It's a really important that editorial is not just that the newspaper say something. It's really important the newspaper have something to say.
Yeah. We at the Bush Institute, we did a series this summer of listening sessions, we call them, with journalists from around the country on a number of different issues about the role of journalism in a democracy. But this subject came up about local recommendations, state recommendations. And I was really struck by the response there, and I later wrote a blog about this, that several of the participants on there were editorial page editors, and they said that they could see a very clear spike in their views, digital views, went on these local and state races, and particularly during primaries. So this blog involved my former colleague, Colleen Nelson, who's
our publisher in Sacramento with McClatchy.
Yeah, and I emailed her over the weekend. Same phenomena is happening now. These recommendations at the state and local level are leading other stories in terms of the views. Ditto with the morning news here in Dallas, that you can see a real spike in these recommendations locally, particularly when you put together, as they do, a summary sheet, the sort that we would take into the ballot box with us. And Detroit News, the editor there, editorial page editor, same thing, and said, you know, it just, these are my words, it in some cases beat the socks off of these other stories, and it had a higher rate of conversions, people reading this and signing up for the paper.
Well, that's the other point about that. People who read the editorials are the same people who've always read the editorials. They're decision makers, they're leaders, they're homeowners, they're people who have a stake in, you know, having low taxes and a good community and a low crime rate. They're people who want their community to be better, their state, their nation. They want to know who's going to help make that decision. Those are the people who read the editorials. I said the editorials need to be strong and outspoken. They also need to be timely in order to have people read it online. The timing has to be right. We used to do editorials that would run a month ahead before, like the week before early voting started, and now we find people aren't looking yet. And so we don't publish until like the week before Election Day. That's when we publish, or when the traffic starts to build and the curiosity starts to build, that's when we publish the endorsement. So, but people are out there looking. We just have had to learn how to find that audience.
Go ahead, Bill. I just say describe a little bit of the process, not to bore your listeners, but you know, in the case of Sacramento, Colleen Nelson said they did 62 recommendations this go round. I don't know how many the Morning News did, I don't know how many the Star Telegram did, but you're seeing all these candidates that are coming in. Oftentimes they may be paired together, they may be coming individually. There are a lot of interviews, and you're having to prepare for these interviews, having to know their previous positions. In case of judgeships, you have to know what this judicial office is about. And so there's a lot of homework, there's a lot of screening of people, and so you aren't just like making this up out of thin air. I'm no longer on editorial board, so I can say this on behalf of Bud and others that do it. It is tedious, and there is a lot of work to it, but that, I think, is where you're having more bang for your buck.
To explain the mechanics of just a tad more here, there's a literal group of people, the editorial board, that will physically meet with candidates.
Opinion writers. Not newsroom reporters.
Right. So they'll physically, I mean, I've only been, I think, two of them in my career, just being able to listen in on those. But you guys will physically meet with candidates, and you'll ask them a number of questions to try to nail down where their positions are.
And we do it virtually, but if you were still doing interviews, you'd know that now sometimes we seem to know more about the office than the people who are running. That's one of the discouraging things.
But what's surprising about this, but you just mentioned, or both of you guys did, about how interest in these opinions are so great now, 20% to 30% of the total traffic. And then I look at, you know, MSNBC and Fox and OAN and the others. Everyone loves opinion news. That just kind of strikes me as why the Washington Post and LA Times wouldn't kind of capitalize on that.
Wouldn't want to be part of that. You know, this morning, what do we have? We had a big Cowboys game last night. I looked at, you know, the most read stories over the weekend. Three political columns were among the 10 most read stories over the weekend.
Right.
And one of the endorsements. So the appetite is there, and it's people come, and we know that people come either to have their opinion reinforced or to find somebody to argue with them. They'll see in a headline, they got to be wrong. You know, Mac Engel, the sports columnist, calls those anger clicks. But
y'all takes know something about anger clicks
from the inside. Yes.
But you have to have that opinion out there, and then people want to see it.
I think it's interesting, though, particularly in the case of the Washington Post, that we saw in the days after, anecdotally, we obviously don't have the numbers, but that a lot of folks have been canceling their subscriptions because they weren't happy with that the endorsement being held back like that. If you are a newspaper and you're trying to not upset, part of the readership, it looks like you've sort of misfired if another part of the readership that actually had subscriptions canceled those subscriptions. And perhaps some of the people that you were worried about upsetting don't really read your paper a whole lot anyway, or don't subscribe to your paper because they think of you as perhaps too liberal.
Well, I would say if you're going to the ownership of a newspaper, don't go into it unless you're comfortable with people being mad at you. And so just don't get involved in it and do something else. But I think this is the point I'm trying to get across. I can understand why some paper, I'm not talking about the Post or the Times. I mean, I think they should have, whatever decision they're going to make, they should have made earlier in the cycle. But for those that are not endorsing, I can understand that.
Yeah.
And if they think, because I don't think they're going to persuade any minds at the presidential level. I think if they want to do it as a statement of principles, that's perfectly fine to do that. But either way, don't do it because you're fearful of the tide.
I want to ask this.
I'll just mention that and these are old figures. I haven't seen these in many years since the downturn in the journalism business. But they used to tell us that when someone cancels because they're mad about something that was in the newspaper, they resubscribe within an average of 22 days.
Interesting.
Because they were so emotionally involved with the newspaper that they miss it. And even though they were mad, they resubscribe within less than a month.
Wow. That's an interesting tidbit. Really, so let's see what happens in 3 weeks.
Can I add one other thing in here?
Absolutely.
I think the important role I'd like to emphasize about these state and local races, this is how journalism can help create community, can help strengthen our democracy and create some stability, because they give people information, and then the people can go out and use that information however they want to and vote yay or vote nay. But it is how the media can be a really instrumental player in strengthening our democracy, which is really important, because we oftentimes hear so much about how awful the media is and how bad the media is, blah, 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 blah. Well, here's living proof that people in California, Detroit, Dallas, elsewhere, they're reading these things because they want that information.
Yeah, I'll say that you all have worked at some great institutions, because I have relied on both of those institutions, the Dallas Morning News and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, in reading about candidates, and have found things that I didn't know about them, and I work as a journalist, but especially from these question-answer sessions, you see tidbits that you go, whoa, I didn't know that, and that does inform my decision on whether or not to vote for this person.
Well, you want to be independent, non-political, and I think that's the most important thing. If people perceive that a newspaper's become partisan, you want to be not non-political, but non-partisan. Independent, non-partisan, that's how you keep the confidence of readers and always have. We're in a more partisan time than we've ever been. It is very difficult to be independent, non-partisan, but that's what people look for from their newspaper.
Let me flip the question. So if these endorsements weren't going to be a surprise, which they weren't going to be, both of these papers were going to endorse Kamala Harris, why was an endorsement even needed then?
Well, that's a good question.
Is it tradition or principle or what?
I honestly cannot speak for each institution because I'm not a part of it. I can only guess that you said in the Post case, they only started endorsing once again with Jimmy Carter in 76, I think it was. And I was surprised they hadn't endorsed up until then. So maybe it's a quasi-tradition, maybe it's a statement of principle. And I forgot the rest of your question.
No, I'm sorry. Well, the principal tradition,
The Post had always endorsed, but they skipped 88.
Yeah,
that was right. And they'd endorsed since. I really think it's prestige and having that headline go around the world that says, the Washington Post endorses, the Los Angeles Times endorses.
Yeah. They got the headline either way, though.
They did.
It may have gotten more attention back. I want to ask about the potential for a chilling effect here, because you start to think, well, if you have been taking positions on you know, presidential candidates, and you've decided to pull out of that because it just feels too hot to touch, okay, why still have an editorial or opinion page in which your writers are taking on these candidates for their individual ideas? Is there a potential for a slippery slope there that it starts to undermine even having that page at all? And then I'll finish by saying another Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, investigative reporter at the Washington Post, Carol Leonig, said in an email that I don't care who the Post opinion section endorses. For me and for the readers and sources who today have flooded me with calls and messages, what's curious is the timing and odd explanation of this endorsement change. It raises concerns about the thing I do care deeply about, whether our ownership will continue to let my colleagues and me pursue hard-hitting reporting independently without worrying who's upset with our coverage. So again, the question is there a potential for a slippery slope here when you see an owner in both of these cases, billionaire owners who may have other interests at stake, intervening like this?
This is the condition of the newspaper industry up until the 90s, is that owners who were millionaire communications, you know, business leaders, only 25% of American newspapers endorsed Franklin Roosevelt during his landslide victories during World War II. Republicans were solidly Republican because their owners were solidly Republican. So you're seeing a return to the conditions in the 20th century, where the owner decides that it's going to be a conservative paper or that it's just not going to endorse at all. In Los Angeles, there have been accusations that an owner might have had some business dealings with the government. I mean, my gosh, Otis Chandler at the Times was Nixon's, you know, right hand on everything. And look at the controversies around Hearst and the other families in the business. This is a look at an industry and the way it used to be. You were talking about the downside and the slippery slope. The real slippery slope, if you don't endorse, is that when you put out those invitations to your editorial board next election cycle, will the candidates come? You know, we've had candidates say, you know, we don't think editorial matter anymore. We're not going to come. And you know, definitely, if you skip races and say we don't think we're going to endorse in that, we're not sure if we're going to have an endorsement, but make time. Come on down. You know, come see us at 10 o'clock on Tuesday. You know, then the candidates might be less likely to come.
Well, Andrew, my hope is, I sure hope not. I sure hope it doesn't lead to a slippery slope, and I hope it doesn't do away with opinions. And because I think it's, as we go forward in a, you know, this fast-changing news environment, I think what, in particular, newspapers can bring is what our former publisher Jim Maroney used to talk about the morning news, PICA, perspective, interpretation, context, and analysis. And all that involves some in an opinion page, and I think we can help people on the editorial and opinion pages, and I still write some columns for the Dallas Morning News, is what does this mean? That is something that opinion pages are uniquely situated to address. What does this mean, and what do we think about it?
And that's what's missing in the nonprofit newspapers of today, too, is that they tell us a lot of news, but they don't tell us, they don't have opinion pages, they don't have analysis, they don't tell us what it means, and that's what's missing. And that's only exists in the for-profit print newspaper.
Yeah, so often you see the story about a domino being pushed down, but you haven't followed it closely enough, and perhaps the story doesn't take you into all of the other dominoes that's going to knock down, and that perspective is gold.
Right. And Bud talked about, you know, the old days of newspapers, even going back into the 1800s through the middle part of the 1900s, it was much more partisan owners and very aggressive owners. And I have to confess, I'd be very tempted not to be the George Steinbrenner of newspaper owners if I owned a newspaper. I'd probably be telling these people what to do all the time. But I think the best ones are the ones who can set down a set of principles. You know, you want fair and impartial reporting. You want informed opinions. You want a good sports sections, and you want to be able to be a part of your community, and then you turn it over to the professionals and let the professionals run it.
And apparently you want really good puzzles these days. That's
really
sells.
That's what
we shouldn't slight here the Hearst newspapers in Texas, the Houston and San Antonio, both have strongly endorsed a presidential candidate. And although the Dallas News and the Star-Telegram are focusing on local, state, regional candidates, the largest paper in Texas,
Express,
I think Houston's larger than Dallas.
Yeah,
and as a matter of fact, San Antonio, just in light of what happened, just ran another full big page, said, we'd like you to remind you, we endorse Kamala Harris.
Trying to capitalize on the headlines there. Let me, my last question, I want to step out of the journalism circle, step into the politics of this. Because as soon as this came out, Trump, rightly so, his campaign said, wow, this is the latest blow for Kamala Harris. But is this a political blow at all for her not to get the endorsement of her hometown newspaper?
Yeah, that assumes that a lot of people really care or were set out to take that newspaper in hand and go into the voting box and say this is what the LA Times says.
It
brings a headline, but I think that people know now people know exactly who the LA Times was going to endorse. And so I don't think that there's any question about it. That's an old line, say, well, you couldn't even get the endorsement of your hometown newspaper. That's being used against Ted Cruz right now in Houston. But that I don't think that it really matters with voters. I don't think it's an effective line. Bill?
I think at this point we're talking about, in Pennsylvania, 3% of voters have not made up their mind. So if you consider it's a battleground state, does this headline really move those 3%? I kind of doubt it. I don't know what it is nationwide, but with the polls are at 48-48, so 4%. I don't know what Jill Stein and the others are getting, but
1% apiece.
Yeah, so there's a very narrow band of voters that are left undecided at this point. And you could ask, what more do you need to know at this point?
Right.
But I don't think this makes that big of a difference to the average person in Pennsylvania or whoever may be undecided. I don't think they're going to slap their heads and go, oh my gosh, the Post and the Times didn't endorse, I'm now going to go vote for X.
That seals the deal for me. Yeah.
When you have two candidates who are this starkly different, I don't think it's going to be a held back endorsement that's going to finally push someone over the fence if they've been sitting on that fence not knowing which one to go for.
It might make a difference in a mayor's race. It might make a difference. I noticed state senator, the Star Telegram did some state senate races the Dallas News didn't do. It might make a difference in a local regional race.
Yeah.
I don't think it. People have their own mind. People get plenty of information about the presidential race. People don't get much information about these down ballot races. They get it from the editorial.
I'll close with this, and I'll ask this of both of you in different ways, but I know that you are, shoe leather to the pavement out there. You talk to a lot of people. You hear from a lot of people. William, I know there at the Bush Institute that you have been working on projects that include people being able to stop yelling past each other and actually be able to talk to each other about politics without, having a fist fight over it. On the topic of these editorial pages, these opinion pages, that's what this is all about, is sharing these ideas. And as you said, Bud, just having this mix of thoughts in one place. Are we capable of this still? Are people capable of still being able to talk about things in a civil way and have a discourse? Because you have to have the discourse to have involvement.
Yes, and I'm an optimist by nature, but yes. Because there are a number of institutions, organizations, people at the grassroots level, at the local level, that are very interested in seeing this continue in our country. We're at this moment now where we're at the zenith, apex, whatever you want to call it, of this campaign. So there's a lot of conflict and there's a lot of heat. The question is, will we revert back in another 2 or 3 months? I certainly hope so, because there is an underpinning of people that are there who are kind of points of light, if you will, who are trying to facilitate these kind of discussions. So that gives me optimism. I think at this very moment, they're not going to win out because we're at the height of the campaign.
I think that's always affected by outside forces when you have a crisis, whether it's an economic crisis, whether it's something like COVID, whether it's war somewhere in the world that affects us. As Bob Schieffer said, everybody read the newspaper when their kid might get drafted. And so when you have something that people really want to know, and that's what brings people to have conversations and come together, when they're really when there's something bigger out there to talk about.
I guess more pointedly for Yolitics listeners out there and viewers, do they go ahead with the Thanksgiving plans to meet the family again at the table where there might be some very vigorous disputes, or do they maybe hold off this year until Christmas?
Yes, but go turn on the Cowboys quickly.
I recommend plasticware.
the silverware out of this.
Well said.
Context is always important in these conversations. That's why I'm glad we could have you guys on. Bud Kennedy from the Star Telegram and Bill McKenzie from George W. Bush Institute.
You.
Thanks so much, guys. We appreciate it. Next time, we're going to have a beer, okay?
Okay.
Bill,
okay. Thank you.
Tell us what you want to have. We'll order for you.
Thank you.
Good deal.
Click subscribe and get Y'all-itics every week. Y'all-itics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.